Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about how and why you need to protect young trees from many different menaces over the winter. We'll also talk to author George Adams about his new book on gardening for the birds. Well, that's a lot to get to. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Vicki, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Vicki. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
And I'm going to guess you're a native Philadelphian. You have that Philadelphia accent.
No, I'm from Aiden, North Carolina.
I figured you were a southern girl down there. Okay, very good. So what can we do for Vicki down in the Carolinas?
I have a jumping iris indoor plant that needs to come in before Saturday because it's going to get down to freezing Saturday.
Even for you guys?
Yes.
You know, it's...
First time.
I'm tired of this, you know, and I'm supposed to get this. I mean, where I live, you know, in Pennsylvania... You know, this is the time of year where you got to be watching, make sure all the plants you want to bring in are in before the freeze. But North Carolina, you're supposed to, like, be outdoors sunbathing through December.
Listen, it'll get warm again, I promise you.
Now, I have to admit, I'm going to express complete ignorance here. What is a jumping iris?
It looks like a spider plant, but it has these beautiful iris-looking blooms, almost like an orchid-looking bloom in January.
Oh, nice. Do the flowers hang down?
Well, it has to have the 12 leaves, and then it sends out a shoot. And on the end of the shoot, there forms a flower.
I'm going to have to get me one of these. That sounds lovely.
What happened was, Sunday, I went out to just look at them and clean it up a little bit, and I stuck my hand down in to get some dead leaves out, and all these wasps started coming up. And I screamed and turned around and ran into the clothesline hole.
Good, good. That's exactly what I would have done.
But they didn't come up but more than about 3 or 4 inches, you know, because it was cold.
Oh, okay, good, good. You got lucky.
So I'm trying to figure out how to get them out of my plant before.
Oh, why don't you just bring them into a nice warm house? They'll probably be so happy.
I bet they would.
You know those things, they will sting you, the wasps. So
no.
Here, how big is the pot?
It's 12 inches across, about 12 inches high.
Okay, so it's not too huge. Okay, so you need a helper. And you're going to get a can of nonstick cooking oil, you know, like Pam.
Uh-huh.
That you spray on a pan and, you know, to make it greasy. And you're going to get heavy gloves. And you're going to go outside again when it's cold. And you and your helper, one of you will wear the gloves. And that person will clean away all the debris wearing those heavy gloves. And the other person will be there with the can of nonstick cooking oil. Any wasps or insects or anything like that that appear, just hit them with a spray of the cooking oil. Essentially what you're doing is using a horticultural oil, which is a century-old non-toxic insect remedy. It'll smother the insect and it'll kill them, but there won't be any chemicals involved. You won't be bringing any nasty things into the house. Then, obviously, you know, we're going to be looking for a little mud nest or a little paper nest. And if we can't see that, what I would suggest is take the plant to, like, another place and then very slowly keep pouring water into it. Get rid of any saucers underneath. Really saturate the soil. And if there is a nest down in the soil, that should do it, because I don't guess you want to repot this thing, right?
Well, we thought about repotting it. There's a lot of jumping irises in that pot,
mm-hmm.
so I could split it up because the roots aren't very long anyway.
Okay, so if we're going to do that, then we're back to one person wearing heavy gloves, the other person on right there on the target with the can of no spray cooking oil, and then you get your work area ready. You turn the pot on its side. And you pull the pot away, and then whatever happens, you'll be prepared for. Maybe there'll be nothing left in there. Maybe it was just a small little paper nest that you've already disturbed and they're gone. Or if you see something, just keep soaking it with the oil. They can't fly. They can't hurt you with that. And that'll give you a real good chance to see what was down there. And then if you're going to repot, that's the best way.
Right. Okay. That's great.
All right, Vic.
I love your show. I listen to it every Saturday.
Oh, well, thank you so much. We're very pleased.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jay, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing just fine, Jay. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
And where is Jay Great?
I am in Pomeroy, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Jay in Pomeroy, PA?
This past spring, I decided to abandon my perennial bed, but I wanted to keep some of the color, so I put several clumps of some of my wildflowers into large terracotta pots to have on my patio.
Right.
Specifically, I had some echinacea and some coreopsis, and they did fabulously in the pots throughout the summer. And I'm wondering if there's an easy way that I can overwinter them in the large terracotta pots to be able to have for future years.
The first thing I want to warn people about, and your call is perfectly timed, thank you, because a lot of people will leave plants in pots outside over winter. And if you are in the center of Center City, Philadelphia, for instance, mm-hmm. you can probably get away with that because the heat sink of the city, because there's so many protected areas with the buildings around them. But you don't have to go far into the suburbs, no further than where you are, to where an exposed pot sitting out because of course, the roots are above the frost line. They're above the soil line.
Yeah,
we get a couple of really hard freezes, some, you know, single-digit nights in a row, and you can lose everything, including the pot. And this goes for plastic to some degree, but especially for terracotta, because you've got soil in there that gets wet, that gets dry. Well, when wet soil freezes, it expands incredibly, and it will absolutely shatter your terracotta pots or even glazed pots. I've seen it make splits in plastic pots that I forgot to dump the soil out of after I took care of the plants. Mm-hmm. Now, if you had plastic pots, one of the things I could suggest, because you still do have space, you have in-ground areas, right?
I do, yeah.
Yes, if you had plastic pots, I would suggest you get a shovel. You dig some holes, and you drop the pots down into the holes. That way you don't have to take the plants out. They get their winter chill. And then in the springtime, you just unbury the living dead and put them back out on display.
I've done that in past.
Yeah, exactly. But you can't do that with terracotta because of the risk of splitting and damage. So your big options are to just pull the plants out of their pots, especially after they go dormant. I mean, nothing bad is going to happen to them on frosty nights. I mean, we're really thinking about, you know, when it drops down into the 20s. So you can really let the plants go dormant. You can shovel them out of there, and then you can do what's called healing them in. Just plant them for the winter, where you don't expect anything to grow. You're just getting their roots below the soil line. And then I would also suggest emptying most or all of the potting soil out of your terracotta and then moving that to a protected area. Because even without soil in it, winter can cause terracotta to start to fall apart, if you know what I mean. Shavings will come off of it.
Sure.
You know, it'll start to splinter. Do you have a garage or a shed or something like that?
I do have a shed. It's unheated.
Yeah.
Will that suffice, or does it, there need to be some sort of a mechanism to keep that above freezing temperature?
Well, now you're shooting craps if you move those into an unheated shed. Obviously, they've got a roof above them. They've got some insulation around them. But again, if it drops down to like 5 degrees, and it's going to be 5 degrees every night for a week, then you're going to have to do something about it, and the ground is going to be frozen solid.
Yeah.
But that's what I think needs to happen. You need to get those roots down below the soil line. But there's no reason you can't perennialize them this way, just moving them around in the spring and the fall.
Okay. Very good, then.
All right, Jay. Good luck, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate your help.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be honored to once again host the Empty Bowl Benefit Dinner for the Homeless on Wednesday evening, November 20th, this year at a brand new location, the Lutheran Theological Seminary on Germantown Avenue in Philadelphia. Then I'll lead a trip to Cuba to explore their botanical wonders this coming January 14th to the 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with gardening for the birds, protecting your young trees over winter, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, winter is a dicey time for new trees. There are many enemies out there who wish to eat them, destroy the bark with their antlers. Even the sun can be their enemy. We'll explain what you need to do to protect new trees when we get to the question of the week. We'll also take lots more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Mr. George Adams, who has written a new book called Gardening for the Birds, How to Create a Bird-Friendly Backyard. It is from Timber Press. And Mr. Adams is himself from and joining us from Australia. Thank you so much for accommodating this weird time machine we have between our two continents here, George.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Mike.
Now, although you are Australian, you go out of your way to say that you wrote this book because you became a great traveler through the United States and traveled here extensively. And your day job, so to speak, is as an architect. And during your travels, you became concerned with urban sprawl displacing the birds and butterflies and creatures that I presume were part of the best parts of your earlier visits.
Yeah, I landed in San Francisco and realized that I was looking at Australian plants everywhere. And I thought, this is crazy. I want to see Californian plants.
George, we were just trying to, you see, this is the good neighbor policy. You know, we were just trying to make you feel comfortable. You know, we couldn't afford the wombats or anything, so we, you know, put a couple of Australian plants in the ground.
It was quite strange to see a hummingbird taking nectar from a bottle brush. I thought, this is not right. You know, this is crazy. Yeah.
Now, this is a big, thick book. And you go into a lot of detail about the native plants that bring in the most wildlife and a lot of detail about the birds themselves. So our show is national, as we realize more and more it's becoming international. So don't feel that you have to be restricted to the Mid-Atlantic or the East Coast. We have listeners all over the country and the world. What are the plants that, at least in the United States, you most saw lacking or saw having the most benefit to being reestablished in gardens?
Well, what I've done is I've looked at all the plants in the United States and I've decided on which ones are most beneficial. I think the problem is, as an architect, as we use up land with the urban sprawl, we demolish habitat for birds. So I was looking for an intensified habitat that I could build and make up for the land that we lost in the building process. So the plants I've got, they flower for a long time or they fruit for a long time and have the best chance of looking after our bird life.
And I'm presuming you're thinking of things like service berries, which are, you know, just seem to be one of the top plants for giving birds what they need.
Well, yeah, but there are some plants that actually attract insects, that attract insect-eating birds. So it's a big variety.
Well, I'll tell you, you spend the first part of the book on plants, and then there's lots of charts about what plants are great for what regions. And then in the back of the book, you have, like, it's almost like four books in one. You have a great birding book, and your favorite birds seem to be some of my absolute favorite birds. I realized years ago I was going to get, because my landscape has been organic for 25 years, it's heavily planted, we're on the edge of the wood, we're lousy with all kind of birds. I realized one thing I could do to help my garden was to specifically go out of my way to invite meat-eating birds, bug-eating birds. And you seem to spend a lot of time on that in the book. And one of your favorites is one of my favorites, and that's the downy woodpecker.
Well, it is, yeah. But actually, as far as insects go, my favorite bird is the Buick's wren. It's quite an amazing bird. It's only a very small bird, but it must eat its own weight in insects every day.
The wrens are a great line of birds. I have Carolina wrens that nest very close to the house. They're almost like chickadees. They almost seem to prefer the company of humans. And so what kind of insects are we talking about with your wren?
It eats all the lousy ones that try and eat vegetables. And no, it eats a pretty wide range of insects, but it tends to leave beneficial insects alone. So it's almost a perfect garden bird.
Well, one of the reasons I picked out the downy woodpecker is, as you know, if you've been traveling in the States, we're having tremendous issues with imported beetles killing trees, you know, bark beetles and boring beetles. And one of the things I've suggested is that people attempt to bring in woodpeckers, chickadees, the nutthatch, the wrens, the birds that kind of make a living going up and down the sides of trees, going for these kind of insects. And I've got the book in front of me. I'm not going to ask you to suddenly turn to a page. But under the feeding habits of the downy woodpecker, you say, wood-boring larvae of insects that damage trees are a favorite food. And that's something I've been suggesting to people. This might be a way to save our ash trees and the other trees that are under attack from these imported boring insects.
Well, that's one thing I recommend in the book. I mean, if you watch these woodpeckers, they actually put their side of their head to the tree and they can actually hear the insects under the bark. And as soon as they hear them, they go after them and they do a great job. And it's something that I'm very interested in, is using birds as a biological control. Unfortunately, they've been wiped out, their habitat's been lost, and, you know, we should be putting nest boxes up in forests and everywhere we can to encourage these birds to do that job.
Another great insect-eating bird is the titmouse. You know, especially oak trees are under attack right now, and you seem to specify that that's one of their prime feeding grounds.
Well, titmice are one of the greatest birds you can have in the garden, with chickadees. And about 100 years ago, they did biological surveys in all over the states, and they picked out birds that were the most valuable for controlling insects. The wrens, the chickadees, the woodpeckers, all those birds do a fabulous job for us in our gardens and forests and farms.
Well, you know, I mean, you probably know this as well as I do. The old farming books, the farming books from the turn of the century, both from Great Britain and England, talk about birds as the farmer's friend and go into great detail about how to attract birds that eat pest flies and pest insects, and how to manage them as pest eaters on your farm. And then, of course, the petrochemical industry, you know, decided they had a better idea.
Yeah, well, in the old days, birds did do the job in beneficial insects. They were the controllers of insects on farms. And so I think we should be looking at going back to that. And now, pesticides have done more harm than they're worth. I mean, I was reading the other day that North America's 300 most pestilous insects, of the 300, 100 of them were only secondary pests before pesticides killed the beneficial insects. So it's just a crazy setup. It's something we should be doing something about.
I try to explain to our listeners all the time, there is no pest that's going to vex you, either inside or outside your home, that there aren't three or four other creatures that like to have that pest for dinner.
Exactly. The idea is, with birdscaping, by having birds in your garden year-round by using the charts, these birds will control the insects, and there's really no need for pesticides in the garden. The other idea is that, you know, if you want a pristine lawn, well, you've got to use herbicides and pesticides for it to look artificial. So, you know, you put in a little prairie garden instead and use native grasses for the lawn, so that you increase the butterfly population and the bird population, and then you enjoy a magnificent little garden without worrying about pests. You don't need pesticides or herbicides. And the beauty of nature is part of your everyday life in the garden.
Well, I have to tell you that we've lived at our current property for about 25 years now. And about 10 years ago, we built a deck off of our master bedroom so that my wife, who just loves sitting out there, could just sit out and look into the woods. And the smile on her face, it is just a riot of bird sounds at dawn and dusk. It is, you know, some people would find it deafening. And I remember going out, you know, one evening at sunset, and they just, like, 30 different calls, and they were obviously having a great time. And I didn't even have to say anything. She just looked over her shoulder at me and said, "They feel safe here."
Yeah, that's beautiful, Mike. It's fantastic. And I think the bird song should be louder. I mean, we're losing so many birds in North America, everywhere. So we're killing these little guys off that are only trying to clean up insects for us and give us a lot of spiritual pleasure in our home. You know, the bird song, the colour, the antics. I guess my vision would be to just let the birds do the job they're doing before the pesticide companies came in.
And I think your book is a great blueprint for people to do that. George Adams is the author of Gardening for the Birds, How to Create a Bird-Friendly Backyard. It is a new book from Timber Press. It's a great book. And he joined us today from Australia, getting up in the middle of the night to join us here on You Bet Your Garden. George, thanks for going to all the trouble, and thanks for your great work in trying to help the birds.
It was a real pleasure, Mike, and it was lovely to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Barbara. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Barbara Fine?
I am in Wrangell, Alaska.
I don't know Wrangell. I traveled in southeastern Alaska. I took the ferry there many years ago. Had a great time. Where is Wrangell?
This is southeastern Alaska. It's about 25 minutes by air from Juneau.
It's so beautiful out there. And Barb, I have to ask you the question I ask all Alaskans. Where are you originally from?
Ketchikan.
Really? Okay, so you're, well, not a native Alaskan, but you grew up there, huh?
Yes, I'm a native Alaskan.
Well, good for you. It's a beautiful place. It's just stunning. What can we do for Barb in Wrangell?
Well, I have strawberries behind my house, and the slugs get to them.
That's, oh, yeah.
What I'd like to know, is there a cure for slugs?
Oh, there's millions of cures for slugs. And I will tell you, I have seen your Alaskan slugs. They're monstrous. They're as big as the ones, you know, people in Seattle and San Francisco think they have, like, the biggest slugs in the world. But yours are the size of baby humpback whales sometimes,
yeah.
It seems.
So, and they like the big strawberries.
And the strawberries get really huge where you are. People think we're talking about, like, the freezer compartment of their refrigerator. But southeast Alaska has a much milder climate than higher up. And obviously a whole summer where it never gets dark. So certain crops, all the cabbages, all the salad greens, and strawberries do very well in your climate.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things that are used to protect against slugs don't work real well when they get wet, which, of course, kind of negates things because slugs are creatures of moisture. But if you have a dry time, you can spread diatomaceous earth, which is a natural product. It's a mined. It's so hard to describe. Diatoms were ancient primitive sea creatures, and there were so many of them in the prehistoric age that there are vast mountains of their fossilized remains, and it's sold as, quote, DE, diatomaceous earth. And it seems like a fine powder, like flour to us, but microscopically it's all glass shards, and slugs can't cross over it. For long-term protection, something you do once and you don't have to do again, there's nothing better than copper. Have you ever tried copper against slugs?
I tried copper wire.
Oh, that's not big enough. You need to get copper flashing. You know, when you put a roof on a house or you fix a roof, the area around the chimney typically has what's called flashing around it to accommodate up to the shingles. And so you can buy these sheets of thin copper that you have to be careful. You have to wear gloves. The edges of copper flashing can be sharp. But slugs can't cross over copper. So, for instance, if your strawberries are in a raised bed, then you just hammer the copper into the top of the raised bed frame, and slugs can no longer get up there. That's a nice solution because it's once and done. There's also a great product you can buy that's sold under various names like Sluggo and Escargo that is a yeasty bait that contains a little bit of iron phosphate. And slugs are attracted to the yeast, but they can't process the iron phosphate. So they go for this bait, and they die. And the old slug baits used to be some of the most toxic chemicals imaginable. But this new world slug bait, not only is it deadly to slugs, but when it breaks down, all it does is add a little bit of iron and a little bit of microbial activity to your soil, both of which are good. But I know it can be expensive to get products in Alaska and to have products shipped into Alaska. So that's why I think your solution, your long-term solution, is surround your strawberry beds with bigger copper barriers. And slugs can't touch copper. It causes a kind of a spark, almost like a kinetic reaction. It like electrocutes them somehow. So it should be a permanent solution.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, a pleasure to talk to somebody in Southeast Alaska. You have you have a safe winter.
Thank you.
Take care.
So long.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind those of you listening to us on broadcast radio that shows like You Bet Your Garden would be on the air without the support of public radio members, and that it's either fall pledge drive time or just afterwards at a lot of public radio stations around the country. So if you became a member, thank you. If you haven't yet become a member, please consider becoming a member of your local public radio station. But don't go checking your membership status just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and the how and the why of protecting young trees over the winter. I'm young Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll warn you about all the terrible things that nature wants to do to your poor young trees over the winter time. Nature wants to scald them, eat them, and bust them up. We'll tell you how to protect those young trees from all these various dangers after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ben, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing well today, Ben. How are you, sir?
I am also doing well. I'm in Yardley, PA.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Ben just outside of Philadelphia?
Well, I'm putting down bulbs for the spring, and I had a number of questions on the right way to do it. The bed is probably about 20 feet long and about maybe 3 feet wide. And I bought, I think altogether, about 200 bulbs of grape hyacinths and something called hyacinthoids. They're Hispanic rose queen, I think was the name of it specifically. And they're supposed to come up a little bit after the grape hyacinths and be a little taller. But my main question was, should I be intermingling them with the grape hyacinths, or is it better to actually plant them back farther in the bed?
Well, actually, what I do with the height of bulbs is the reverse, Ben. I put the tallest ones towards the front. See, because it's one thing to watch the show, but after the bulb show is over, if you want these bulbs to perennialize, you know, to flower again the following year, you have to let their greenery alone until it turns brown. And that's where a lot of people fall down. After the flowers fade, the greenery's out there, and people get antsy. Gardeners always want to do too much, so they'll go out and they'll mow it down, or they'll cut it down, or the worst of all is they'll go tie up the leaves, thinking somehow bulbs in bondage is a great post-springtime display. And I have done circles of bulbs where in the center I've had the littlest bulbs, the earliest bulbs come up. And then in a circle around those, I've done bulbs that come up a little after that that are a little taller until we get all the way to the outside. And the latest blooming bulbs and the tallest ones, which typically are the big tulips, would be the last thing to come up and would be the outside. And if you do it correctly, what happens is the newly emerging bulbs hide the greenery of the old ones, often long enough for some of that greenery to turn brown. So you're always seeing flowers. That's how I like to do it.
Okay. So, well, actually, my initial plan was to do the shorter grape hyacinths, then the hyacinthoids, which are a little taller, and then I have foxglove behind that. But you're saying that maybe it should actually be the other way in terms of height.
Yeah, are the foxglove plants or seeds?
Well, we had plants last year, and then we did what somebody at a nursery had suggested, where you basically take the seeds off the the dead branches and spread them in the dirt. And she said the odds, you know, it's not like you're going to get the exact same size plant next year, but it'll happen over time.
So you're like, yeah, well, it's like self-seeding, except you're helping them across the street.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's one of the keys here. And first of all, I want to drop back. When you're planting bulbs, the more the better. I fear you might not have enough bulbs.
Oh, really?
To put
I
on?
Thought
oh,
I had
yeah.
Too many.
No, especially grape hyacinth. I planted in a half whiskey barrel. You know what those things look like?
Yeah.
I planted, I think, 500 grape hyacinth. It was like a Japanese subway car at rush hour. They were like back to back, neck to neck, side to side. There was no room in between them. And it was a killer show. If you're thinking of buying a bag of 50, buy a bag of 100. Go crazy. Because let's face it, when these things come up, we're desperate. We're tired of looking at our spouse in the wallpaper. We need some color. We don't want little bits of color. You know, we want garden Prozac. We want something that's going to, you know, give us hope again, give us life. So pack them in tight. And the smart money says to have the taller plants coming up in front, and then you won't have to do anything. You'll have a perfect sequence where you'll always be looking at attractive plants and flowers.
Okay. Well, that sounds like great advice. I'm going to give that a shot this year and probably end up having to buy another couple hundred next year.
Exactly. And for those of people who are worried out there, 90% of the country, it is just now bulb planting time. It is not nearly too late. Even up in some of the colder zones, very safe to get these things in the ground by Thanksgiving.
Perfect. That was my other question. That's awesome. Well, thanks so much, Mike. I love the show.
All right, Ben. Thank you.
All right. Take it easy.
1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, it's nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, Mary. Where are you?
South Florida, very far South Florida.
Oh, yeah, very far. How far south?
in Broward, just north of Miami-Dade.
Okay, so you are looking forward to a warm winter with all of the snowbirds coming down to escape our ice dams on our roof, right?
Yeah, exactly. Do that.
Are you a year-round Floridian?
Yes, yes, been here 15 years.
Okay, very good, very good. What can we do for you?
Well, I work in a restaurant, so I have access to a lot of coffee grounds, and I've just sort of discovered you recently, and you've changed my whole outlook on organic gardening, so I'm really trying to get into it. So I do the compost, and I can add the coffee grounds, no problem, but I also have access to a lot of iced tea grounds. We make a lot of iced tea. Is that, I know it can't hurt, but is it similar in effect as the coffee?
You know, this question has come up quite a bit. I have not been able to find a lot of information on it, which is curious because we drink almost as much tea as we drink coffee. And so there's all this tea ground, so to speak, laying around with coffee grounds. But coffee grounds have been much better researched. Now, one problem I've seen when I visited Florida is, of course, your lack of deciduous trees. So what do you use for the brown material in your compost?
We have a lot of mango trees and avocado trees.
Right.
That drop their leaves a lot. I unfortunately had to cut down the avocado tree this year. It was infested with termites, and but the neighbors are more than happy to provide leaves.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So the advantage, if you've heard me talk about composting, to combining the coffee grounds with shredded brown material is the coffee grounds are very rich in nitrogen. They're very acidic. The brown material is all carbon. And that combination makes the best compost fastest. Although you cheater, your compost gets done faster than anybody's because it stays so much warmer over the winter down there.
Oh, that's true. I do have a turning device because when I had it on the ground years ago, it was, well, a rat built its nest in there. And
yeah.
Then you have problems with the palmetto bugs and
yeah.
the roaches and, we have so many fruit trees. We have rats and mice.
And you mentioned the termites. I mean, you have many more species of termites than we do here in the north. And That's the dichotomy. That's the price you pay. You have a 12-month growing season, but as you move down through every growing zone to higher zones, to warmer climates, the pests and diseases just explode exponentially.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's probably very smart for you to have a contained composting thing.
Yep.
So I have been thinking about this tea issue, and I'm thinking that rather than be like coffee grounds, I think used tea leaves are more like tree leaves. Tea is, I think basically most of the tea we drink comes from a plant that is very similar, related to the camellia. So after we brew these leaves, I'm thinking that they're going to be more carbonaceous. They're going to be more like tree leaves than coffee grounds, which of course are a totally different thing. Coffee, the coffee beans are the most intense part of the plant, you know, the most concentrated source of nutrients. They're essentially the seeds of a new plant, whereby tea leaves are just that, are just leaves. So I would actually think that if you use a lot of tea leaves, and say a quarter as much coffee grounds, that I think you would have a perfect combination. I think coffee and tea together could make great compost. Say 3/4 tea and 1/4 coffee.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, I didn't think there was any way it was going to hurt.
Oh, no. I compost all our tea bags and tea leaves and stuff like that. The one interesting thing I have to remind myself is when we're using tea that has, you know, the bags with the little staples to hold the tags on, I have to cut those staples off to make sure it doesn't go into my worm bin because that could hurt my little wormies.
Oh, that's true. No, the one I have is industrial, so it's not in tea bags. It's just in big pots.
Yeah, I would be curious to see what would happen if you would combine 3/4 used tea leaves with 1/4 coffee grounds. I think you would get remarkable compost really quickly anywhere, but especially in your climate.
Well, I'll try it. Absolutely.
All right. Well, it's great to hear from you. Let us know how it goes and have an enjoyable summer and get the guest room ready for me.
Shall do. We will see you in January.
All right. Take care, Mayor.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Young trees need their bark protected in winter from hungry rabbits, horny deer, and even from the sun. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. John, who lives in McLean, Virginia, but whose question is about his getaway place in Charles County, Maryland, writes, I wrap my young trees every winter to protect them from deer rubbing their antlers and destroying the bark, and in some cases, the trees. Before I started doing this, I had the bark completely stripped off some of my young trees, which of course then died. But I haven't had a single scratch in the 3 years I've been wrapping the trees from mid-October through February. I use rolls of 6-inch wide professional paper and fiber mesh wraps to cover the trees from about a foot off the ground to a height of around 4 feet. Both work well, but it seems like 36-inch fiberglass window screening would work just as well and be a lot easier for me to apply. Your thoughts would be much appreciated.
Well, my first thought is to thank John for this very timely reminder that young trees need protection against bark rubbing by horny young bucks, which the young males do both to mark their territory and to help remove the velvety coating on their brand new antlers.
And don't deer also eat the bark of baby trees?
Absolutely. Deer of both sexes will nibble on the bark of young trees during harsh winters. Especially, it seems, the bark of fruit trees, which must taste like the fruit the tree would have produced had those giant stomachs with legs not killed it. Rabbits are also well-known bark chewers. They just attack closer to the ground. And if any creature succeeds in eating or otherwise destroying the bark in a complete circle around the tree, that tree is a goner.
Wow, it can't heal or be repaired?
No, trees are really good at healing even large wounds. But if the bark is removed in a complete circle, the tree can't get nutrients up past that spot. That's why I used tree guards on my peach trees when they were babies. They were spirals of white plastic that were easy to get on and off the trunks. As per the instructions and some ancient wisdom, I put the guards on at Halloween and took them off around Easter.
Can't you just leave them on?
No, that could do damage to the tree by restricting the bark while it was actively growing.
I can see paper stopping nibbling, but is it enough protection against antlers?
Well, you know, I had the same thought, that you would need something really sturdy, like my plastic guards or the small metal cages that some people use. And I told John I was skeptical that paper would even be sold for this purpose. So he sent me links to his suppliers, and it turns out that these wraps are designed to protect trees from sun scald, a condition that can occur when bright winter sun warms a tree up enough to get a little sap flowing. Then, when the temperature plummets that night, the sap freezes and the bark splits open, stressing the tree and creating an opening for insects to move in. Sun scald damage is especially prevalent in regions with warm, sunny winter days and freezing cold nights, which a Colorado Extension bulletin warns is a common occurrence in many parts of that state. It can even be caused indirectly when bright sunshine reflects off a deep white snow cover.
Yeah, I know how blinding snow glare can be. I finally learned to wear sunglasses when I was out shoveling on a really sunny day.
Right, otherwise you go inside and you're snow blind. Anyway, sun scald damage typically occurs on the south-southwest side of trees where they get the most sun. Commercial orchardists prevent this by coating that side of their trees with white latex paint.
I wouldn't want to do that to trees that other people can see. It would look like they'd been vandalized.
Thus, the wrapping solution. Now, some references specify using white paper to reflect the sun the way white paint does, and come to think of it, the way my white plastic tree guards probably did. But it seems like any light color will do the job.
But back to John's antler protection question.
Well, the paper wrap that's sold for sunscald prevention is thick and crinkly, and I trust John's reportage and several other people mentioned it working to prevent antler rubbing specifically in the product reviews. So until somebody tells me it doesn't work, I won't recommend against it.
But you still haven't answered his specific question.
Ugh, just when I need a cop. Okay, so to finally answer John's question, I think he'd be foolish to change something that he reports is working so well. But I do advise he extend the protection all the way down to the ground to guard against rabbits, voles, and other low-down nibblers. Well, that sure was a lot of interesting information about protecting tiny trees, now wasn't it? Luckily for those of you who want more details, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes! My producer is threatening to remove my wrappings if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And when you send us your email, please, please, please tell us where you live, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Bob Halls. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our tightly wrapped staff includes editor Al Banks, production assistant Effie Kong, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm too old and tough to have to guard against young nibblers. So I guess I'll just see you next week. Some people mistake treasure for trash and gasp, put their leaves out at the curb. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to best utilize these SPBs. Plus your fabulous phone calls.